The farmers must receive most of the water. Their collective thirst is much greater than that of the cities. And in 1985, work on the extension aqueduct to Tucson, the only big potential urban buyer besides Phoenix, had not even begun. What this in turn implies is subsidy, more than is already there in the form of cheap electricity and interest exclusion. Subsidy on a rather heroic scale. The question is, how will it be done? One person who thought he had figured it out was Sam Steiger, a former congressman from Prescott, a small city up in north-central Arizona. In the 1960s, Steiger was a prototypical Arizona Republican, crew-cut, jut-jawed, arch-conservative, who nonetheless had little trouble voting for the cap. Of course I was for it. Any Arizona politician who wanted any kind of political future had to be for it. Besides, I was on the Interior Committee, which authorized the thing, one of two Arizonans versus five Californians on the committee. If I had voted against it, I would probably have been shot. In the 1980s, however, Steiger, no longer in office, had gotten into the water brokering business, which was becoming a cottage industry in western states, whose laws permitted some degree of free market in water rights. Suddenly, Steiger had an economic interest in the very condition the cap would pretend to relieve, scarcity, because he was earning a living helping people with good water rights, mainly farmers, sell those rights to people who could pay top dollar for them, usually sub-developers in cities. If the cap suddenly brought in a big volume of water to be sold at vastly subsidized rates, or if cap water was somehow forced on cities that didn't really want to buy it, it would create an artificial glut and hurt his business. But that was exactly what Steiger thought would happen. Subsidy and political coercion were going to create a demand for cap water which even this third driest state in the country would otherwise not exist. In the first place, Steiger said during an interview in 1985, we passed a strict groundwater law here in 1980, one that was supposed to have been passed 10 years earlier. The cap legislation we passed in 1968 demanded it. What was the point of approving the project if the farmers kept sending the aquifer down to hell anyway? When the Carter people threatened to withhold funds for the cap until a law was passed, it finally went through the state legislature. What that law does, besides restrict pumping, is demand that any developer who sells a new home guarantee the buyer a 100-year supply of water. Otherwise, he can't sell. Hell, I can sell you a home and guarantee you that in 100 years I'll give you desalted water from the ocean. I'll be dead then anyway. That's how ridiculous the provision is. But the way it's being interpreted by the Department of Water Resources is this. No developer gets his certificate unless he signed up for cap water, and without that certificate, he can't sell his house. The odds that there'll be water in the Granite Reef Aqueduct in 100 years are probably lower than the odds we'll be getting water from the ocean, but the developers are stuck. So are the cities. If a city wants to grow, it has to buy water from the Central Arizona Project. That, by Steiger's reasoning, was how the cities would be forced into the hand. The farmers, he felt, would be corralled by the new law's restrictions on groundwater pumping. At some point, they would have to rely more on surface water, and the only available surface water would be the cap. The problem with the farmers, though, is that their demand is, to use that economist's word, inelastic. Charge them too much and they'll go belly up. So the farmers, according to Steiger, will be brought in with a carrot rather than the stick. In 1984, the first 50-year contracts for cheap Hoover Dam power expired. The dam was finally paid off. The new contracts negotiated by the Interior Department didn't raise the rates much, but they did tack on the surcharge of 4 mils per kilowatt hour, which is to go as a direct subsidy to the cap. 4 mils per kilowatt hour, a few cents per day, may not sound like much, but multiply it by a couple of million users, and it is a fair piece of change, millions of dollars per year. It is an almost poetic irony that most Hoover power is sold in Southern California. At last, Arizona was going to get its pound of flesh from California, after involuntarily loaning that state water for so many years. A similar, smaller subsidy applies to power sold by the Navajo power plant. On top of that, the Central Arizona Conservancy District, the Imperium created to receive and distribute cap water, is permitted, by law, to buy cheap Hoover power and resell it at market rates, funneling the profits directly into the project to subsidize the water. Add all this nonsense to Congress's interest-free loan for distribution systems and some other things they're bound to cook up, and it's all of a piece, Steiger said with palpable disgust. They'll skin the cat 20 ways if they have to, but they're going to make the water affordable. Congress will go along because it will be goddamn embarrassing for Congress to have authorized a multi-billion-dollar water project when there's no demand for the water because no one can afford it. The cap belongs to a holy order of inevitability. Will Congress bail out the big banks that pushed all those loans on Latin America when the countries finally default? Of course. Will it make water affordable for Arizona's farmers? Of course. The sensible thing would have been for the farmers to move, Steiger said. There are hundreds of thousands of acres of good farmland right along the Colorado River where you'd only have to build short diversion canals and maybe pump the water uphill a few hundred feet. But the farmers got established in the central part of the state because of the Salt River Project. The cities grew up in the middle of the farmland. The real estate interests, the money people, they're all in Phoenix and Scottsdale and Tucson. They didn't want to move. So we're going to move the river to them. At any cost, we think. Chapter 9. The Peanut Farmer and the Pork Barrel. At the restaurant in the Dillard Motor Hotel in Clayton, Georgia, a little town in a mountainous northern corner of that state, a yellowed old newspaper clipping has been posted by the telephone for years. The story includes a photo showing two men in an open canoe going through Bull Sluice, a Class 5 rapids on the Chattooga, one of the South's preeminent whitewater streams. According to the official classification system of the American Whitewater Affiliation, a Class 5 rapids consists of extremely difficult, long, and very violent rapids with highly congested routes, which nearly always must be scouted from shore. Rescue conditions are difficult, and there is significant hazard to life in event of a mishap. In the photo, the man in the stern of the canoe looks scared to death, but the man in the bow has a look of grim Annapolis determination on his face, as if he were smoking out a nest of wasps. According to the story, which is dated sometime in 1972, this was the first run of Bull Sluice in an open canoe ever. Others have their doubts about that, which is, of course, to be expected on a river with a sort of reputation. But most everyone acknowledges that even if they were not the very first, they were among the first. The man in the stern is Claude Terry, an expert local river runner. The man in the bow is the governor of Georgia, Jimmy Carter. The lore of the South could not survive without rivers any better than the human body could survive without blood. Rivers wind through Twain's and Faulkner's and James Dickey's prose. They flow out of Stephen Foster's lyrics. Yet it is the South, more than any region except California, that has become a landscape of reservoirs, and Southerners, more than anyone else, are still at the grand old work of destroying their rivers. With one hand, they dam them. With the other, they channelize them. The two actions cancel each other out. The channelized streams promote the floods the dams were built to prevent, and the whole spectacle is viewed by some as a perpetual employment machine invented by engineers. The reasons behind the South's infatuation with dams were somewhat elusive. Precipitation in the South is uniformly ample. The rivers run well and often flood, and good dam sites are, or were, quite common. But the same applies to New England, and there the landscape contains relatively few dams. There are water supply reservoirs and small power dams, but only a handful of mammoth structures backing up 20-mile artificial lakes, which are encountered everywhere in the South. Whatever the reasons, It is an article of faith in the South that you send a politician to Washington to bring home a dam. The first Southern politician of national stature who went on record opposing one may have been Jimmy Carter. Carter's misgivings about dams appear to have been rooted in metaphysics, flintiness, and a sense of military honor. As a businessman, a state legislator, and the chairman of the Middle Flint River Planning and Development Council, he was at first enthusiastic when the Army Corps of Engineers announced plans to erect Sproul Bluffs Dam, a $133 million structure on the Flint, which is one of Georgia's larger rivers. However, some of Carter's personal friends belonged to the state's environmental community, and about the same time he was running for governor, they introduced him to canoeing and river rafting, a sport with which he immediately fell in love. Caught between political expediency, many of the state's business and labor interests were equally in love with the Sproul Bluffs Dam, and the appeals of close friends and his own changing values, Carter decided to make up his mind purely on the facts. He got a copy of the Corps' general plan and environmental statement, closeted himself in a room, and displaying that passion for detail that was to contribute to his political undoing, read it from cover to cover. He cross-checked its assertions with a number of experts. He did his own math. He graded the Corps' hydrology. Carter had graduated from Annapolis as an engineer. In the end, he wrote a blistering 18-page letter to the Corps, accusing it of computational manipulation and of ignoring the environment. Then, exercising his gubernatorial discretion, he vetoed the dam. According to friends, Carter was deeply incensed by the Corps' reliance on deception to justify the dam. As an Annapolis graduate, he didn't believe a military unit would do such a thing. And, perhaps because he did go to Annapolis instead of West Point, he took it personally. "The Corps of Engineers lied to me," he told his friends. He said it as if a stranger had wandered into his house, eaten everything in the icebox, and then, on leaving, chopped down his favorite tree. Carter also possessed something rare among American politicians, a sense of history. And according to those close to him, he began to wonder what future generations would think of all the dams we had built. What right did we have, in the span of his lifetime, to dam nearly all the world's rivers? What would happen when the dam silted up? Fixed, huge, and permanent, dams were also oddly vulnerable. What if the climate changed? What if there were floods which the dams, their capacity drastically reduced by silt, couldn't hold? What if there were terrible droughts, and farms and desert cities that owe their existence to dams faced economic ruin? Besides, having already built 50,000 of them, what were we getting for our investment now? By the time Carter became president, the cumulative federal debt was approaching $1 trillion, and inflation had already visited the double digits. But the federal water bureaucracies were still going through $5 billion every year. One of the first things he was going to chop out of the federal budget was dams. To a degree that is impossible for most people to fathom, water projects are the grease gun that lubricates the nation's legislative machinery. Congress without water projects would be like an engine without oil. It would simply seize up. If an influential Southern member of Congress didn't much like a program designed to aid a certain part of the Northeast, then it would not be unheard of for the congressional delegation from that region to help him get a dam built in his state. If a senator threatened to launch a filibuster against a particular program, perhaps the program's advocates could muster support for the senator's favorite water project. In the Congress, water projects are a kind of currency, like wampum, and water development itself is a kind of religion. Senators who voted for drastic cuts in the school lunch program in 1981 had no compunction about voting for $20 billion worth of new Corps of Engineers projects in 1984, the largest such authorization ever. A jobs program in a grimly depressed city in the Middle West, where unemployment among minority youth is more than 50%, is an example of the discredited old welfare mentality. A $300 million irrigation project in Nebraska, giving supplemental water to a few hundred farmers, is an intelligent, far-sighted investment in the nation's future. Among members of Congress, the intricate business of trading favors is commonly referred to as the courtesy system, or more quaintly, the buddy system. Among its critics, a category that extends to include anyone who has not yet benefited from it, it is called log rolling, back scratching, or most often, the pork barrel. The phrase pork barrel derives from a fondness on the part of some southern plantation owners for rolling out a big barrel of salted pork for their half-starved slaves on special occasions. The near riots that ensued as the slaves tried to make off with the choicest morsels of pork were, apparently, a source of substantial amusement in the genteel old South. Sometime in the 1870s or 1880s, a wag decided that the habitual efforts by members of Congress to carry large loads from the federal treasury back to their home districts resembled the feeding frenzies of the slaves. The usage was quite common by the late 1880s, and in 1890 it showed up in a headline in the New York Times, assuring its immortality. Members of Congress who believe in the system, there are many who fervently do, and probably an equal number who dislike it but go along, argue that it benefits the nation as a whole by distributing public works money to all the 50 states in more or less equal proportion. It doesn't. Anyway, to say the Congress cannot function without the courtesy system is to say that it cannot conduct its business without indulging in bribery, extortion, and procuring. Ideology is the first casualty of water development. Senator Alan Cranston of California, who was well out on the left of the Democratic Party, spearheaded the successful effort to sextuple the maximum acreage one could legally own in order to receive subsidized reclamation water. Having accomplished that, Cranston, heavily financed by big California water users, launched his presidential campaign, railing against special interests. Senator Ernest Gruening of Alaska, who built a reputation as one of the most ardent conservationists in Congress, also campaigned mightily for Rampart Dam, which, if built, would have destroyed more wildlife habitat than any single project ever built in North America. In 1980, Steve Sims of Idaho, a right-wing small businessman, ran against and defeated Senator Frank Church, one of the Senate's most respected liberals. The one thing they ever agreed on was that the Bureau of Reclamation ought to build Teton Dam. New Age politicians who strive to disassociate themselves from the old left or the old right seem to fall into the same old habits where the pork barrel is concerned. In 1984, Senator Gary Hart of Colorado ran for president as a neoliberal and a self-proclaimed expert on how to trim the federal budget. He also supported, consistently, a couple of $1 billion worth of unbuilt Colorado reclamation and salinity control projects, most of them sporting costs far greater than benefits. Former Governor Edmund G. Brown, Jr. of California, flew to London at his own expense to attend the funeral of his hero, E.F. Schumacher, who wrote Small is Beautiful, then returned to promote what could turn out to be the most expensive single public works project ever built, the expansion of the California Water Project. Politicians beach themselves in such ideological shallows for various reasons. The power of money, the selfishness of their constituents, or their own venality. The system thrives as it does, however, largely because of the power and nature of the committee system in Congress.
The leadership of the Appropriations and Public Works Committees that approve and fund water projects traditionally comes from the South and West, where water projects are sacrosanct.
In 1980, for example, Congressman Jamie Whitten of Mississippi was chairman of the House Appropriations Committee. Congressman Tom Bevel of Alabama was chairman of its Subcommittee on Public Works. Congressman Ray Roberts of Texas was chairman of the House Public Works Committee. Jennings Randolph of West Virginia was chairman of the Senate Environmental and Public Works Committee. Mike Gravel of Alaska was chairman of its Subcommittee on Water Resources. Mark Hatfield of Oregon was chairman of the Senate Appropriations Committee. In that same year, 1980, 288 individual projects were included for funding in the Omnibus Public Works Appropriations Bill. Only 8 got more than $25 million. All but one of the 8 were located in the South or West. The most expensive item on the menu was the $3 billion Tennessee Tom Bigbee Waterway, which was to receive $243 million in a single year. The waterway is in the districts of Bevel, Witten, and the immortal John Stennis, who was second in seniority on the Senate Appropriations Committee that year. Together, the House and Senate committees and the water development agencies run a remarkably efficient operation. They work in concert, rewarding those who vote for water projects and punishing those who do not, sometimes to the point of stopping virtually any federal money from going into their districts. They would, of course, much rather use the carrot than the stick. In 1978, before he had even set foot in Washington, Senator-elect Alan Simpson of Wyoming was paid a special visit by three high-ranking officers in the Corps of Engineers, asking if there was anything they could do for him. Once in Washington, Simpson was approached again, this time by the leaders of the appropriate committees, who made him the same offer. Every freshman senator and congressman got the same treatment, even Bob Edgar. "The old boy network comes to you," says Edgar, who was elected to the House of Representatives in 1974 at the age of 31. "They say, you've got a water project in your district? You want one? Let us take care of it for you." Then they come around a few months later and get their pound of flesh. You actually risk very little by going along. You get a lot of money thrown into your district for a project that few of your constituents oppose. In return, you vote for a lot of projects your constituents don't know about or care about. Not many of my constituents are going to base their vote for or against me on whether or not I supported Stonewall Jackson Dam in West Virginia. Then everyone wonders why we're running such big federal deficits, and they cut the social programs, which must be the culprit. As it turned out, Edgar did not support Stonewall Jackson Dam in West Virginia, nor did he support dozens of other projects earmarked for funding in the Appropriations Committee that year. He has even made a concerted effort to have them taken out year after year. For this, Edgar has become a virtual pariah among his colleagues and a hero among conservation groups. By general consensus, no one among the 535 members of Congress has been quite as willing to risk his political career attacking the pork barrel system. The reason may have something to do with the fact that Edgar is a former Methodist minister who became a congressman almost by accident. Well-built, handsome, a picture of rectitude and repose, he was in the early 1980s perhaps the most stubbornly principled person in that legislative body, a distinction that has worked against him at every turn. "Some of my colleagues come up to me and say, 'Bob, I wish I had your guts,' says Edgar. Then they attack me on the floor." Actually, Edgar has a built-in advantage in his district. He represents suburban Philadelphia, and it would be difficult for the Corps of Engineers to tantalize his constituents with a water project. Where would one build one in the suburbs?
And then see to it that the appropriations committees deny him funds, a strategy which, according to a number of congressional staff aides, has been used on numerous occasions with good results. Still, federal public works money has, in recent years, tended to detour around Edgar's district. His colleagues have also subjected him to threats. "Tim Lee Carter of Kentucky came up to me once after I fought to remove Paintsville Lake from the appropriations bill," says Edgar. "He was blazing mad. He punched a finger in my chest and said, 'I know nothing about the Philadelphia shipyard, but I will.' Another congressman told me he hopes I am successful in knocking off his project because then hundreds of his constituents will walk into my district and work for my defeat." After a while, it is difficult to remain principled in such an atmosphere, let alone be effective. "Congress as an institution is pretty sick," says Bob Eckhart, who was a liberal congressman from Houston until his defeat in 1980. "It has two diseases, special interestitis and parochialism. My opponent made a big issue out of the fact that I was too generous to the Northeast. He said I voted to guarantee New York City's loan when the money could have been spent in Texas. He boasted about not being a candidate with a national perspective. New Yorkers are just as parochial in their own way.
Liz Holtzman of New York feels the question of a Concorde landing at Kennedy Airport is as important as the Equal Rights Amendment. People like Pat Moynihan, the Democratic senator from New York, oppose Western dams but want to waste even more money on a crazily expensive project like Westway. If New York City had gone bankrupt in 1975, it would have been a terribly serious blow to the bond markets of many other cities, including places like Boise, Idaho, and Jackson, Mississippi. I didn't detect that many members recognized that fact or cared about it if they did. They mainly didn't want to be accused of spending their constituents' money on a lousy place like New York. "We are a tyranny presiding over a democracy," says Edgar. Congressman Floyd Fithian of Indiana has a water project planned for his district which he doesn't want. He wants it out of the bill, deauthorized. I don't know whether a majority of his constituents support him or not, but that should be his problem and their problem. He should be able to take a project out of his own district, and if his constituents don't like it, they can vote him out of office. But he hasn't been able to remove the project from the appropriations bill. Congressman John Myers sits on the Appropriations Committee and its Energy and Water Development Subcommittee. He has some big construction people in his district, which is next door to Floyd's, who would get some big contracts if the project is built. So every time Fithian tries to remove the project, Myers puts it back in. It's pathetic to watch what can happen to grown men here. One guy had a good project, I thought it was good, in the 1978 appropriations bill, but Ray Roberts yanked it out because he was upset over a couple of votes the guy had cast. He had the poor congressman crawling up to him on his hands and knees for a year. He finally got his project back. Ray jerked him around like a beaten dog. It was against this system that Jimmy Carter, a rube from Georgia who had never been elected to public office outside the state, decided to declare war. Carter's appointments alone probably got him off on the wrong foot. In their own way, they were like Ronald Reagan's chemical industry people taking over the EPA. His Interior Secretary, Cecil Andrus, had been governor of Idaho, and before that, a sawmill owner. But Andrus was a stranger to Washington, and he had made a reputation in Idaho as an unusually conservation-minded governor from a state full of millionaire sheep ranchers and irrigation farmers. Andrus's assistant secretary, Guy Martin, looked like a bearded logger, but he was a lawyer and made a reputation as a politically canny resources director under another conservationist governor, Jay Hammond of Alaska. The first head of Carter's Council on Environmental Quality was Charles Warren, probably the most active conservationist in the California legislature. One of the other members, later chairman, was Gus Speth, a lawyer from the arch-conservationist Natural Resources Defense Council. Speth was a Yale-educated Rhodes Scholar from Orangeburg, South Carolina, who had a dense drawl, resplendent southern charm, and Carter's ear on water projects and nuclear energy, which he had fought relentlessly at NRDC. Catherine Fletcher, a scientist with the equally arch-conservationist Environmental Defense Fund, became a natural resource specialist under Stuart Eisenstadt, the head of Carter's domestic policy staff. In the Environmental Protection Agency and the Interior Department were a dozen more high- and middle-level appointees pulled off the environmental organization's staffs. All of the conservation groups were, of course, beside themselves with glee to lose so many people to Carter. In view of the astonished anger that greeted the appointments among the entrenched committees in Congress, however, they may have been one of the worst mistakes Carter made. Long before the inauguration, Carter's domestic policy staff, under Eisenstadt, was working up alternatives to the Ford budget it had inherited for fiscal year 1978. Since Carter's most dramatic campaign promise had been to balance the federal budget by the end of his first term, he needed to make substantial cuts right away. Besides that, like many new presidents, he wanted to inaugurate his term by doing something bold. In a series of memoranda, Eisenstadt gave him his options. There weren't many. Most of the budget was soaked up by defense and the entitlement programs, and it seemed impossible to touch the discretionary part of the budget without ruffling the feathers of some large interest group. In February of 1977, on a working weekend, Carter flew to Georgia for the first time aboard the Doomsday Plane, the jet from which the president is supposed to run the country, or what is left of it, in the event of a nuclear war. His reading material was the Eisenstadt issue paper on water projects. Sitting there, imagining himself running an incinerated nation from an airplane, Carter worked himself into a negative mood. As he flipped through Eisenstadt's memo, which was written largely by Kathy Fletcher, Carter began to smolder. "There is no coherent federal water resources management policy," he read. "Extensive overlap of agency activities, several million acres of productive agricultural and forest land and commercial and sports fisheries have been ruined, while other large expenditures have been made to protect these resources, overlapping and conflicting missions, large-scale destruction of natural ecosystems, the pork barrel, obsolete standards, self-serving, pressure from special interests." By the time he returned from Georgia, according to one of his aides, he knew how he was going to make his big splash. He called up his chief lobbyist, Frank Moore, and told him to put Congress on notice that he wanted to cut all funding for 19 water projects. That same day, Cecil Andrus, who knew nothing of this, stepped on a plane and flew off to Denver for a Western Governors Conference on that year's severe drought. The incident demonstrated a characteristic that was to plague the Carter administration for the rest of its term, a capacity for mind-boggling political naivete. That the news of the hit list got out before Andrus was even notified was soon attributed to a leak within the White House, and the culprit was identified, by sly innuendo, as Kathy Fletcher. According to one of Carter's own legislative aides, however, the source of the news was none other than Carter himself. "He told Frank Moore to put the Hill on notice that he wanted those projects cut," says the aide. "The projects had been selected at a meeting attended by Andrus, but he didn't know they were actually going to go ahead with the idea. He was opposed to it from the start." Whatever the case, the timing was miserable. It was 1977, and California was in the midst of its driest year on record. The year before had been the third driest, and Auburn Dam was on the hit list. Though Auburn's existence would hardly have helped the state a bit, no one was about to notice that during a drought. Colorado, whose mountains were so bereft of snow that many of the ski slopes were closed in February, had three projects on the list, the most of any state. None of them would have helped much either, but reason is the first casualty in a drought. The Central Arizona project was already half-built, but it too was on the hit list. The Western governors, who saw by Andrus's own embarrassed and baffled reaction the hopeless disarray of the Carter administration, milked the incident for all it was worth. Governor Richard Lamm of Colorado had to plumb the depths of his emotions to convey properly his deep and profound sense of outrage and shock. "We're not going to be satisfied," Lamb shouted at a huge crowd of scribbling reporters, "until we get our projects back." Governor Raul Castro of Arizona was stunned and angry. The ever-opportunistic Jerry Brown of California, who had won over the state's powerful environmental community by publicly opposing the only two federal dams then being built in California, Auburn and New Maloney's, made one of his deft about faces and said, "We want to build more dams." The reaction from Congress was even stronger. Congressman Morris Udall of Arizona immediately dubbed the incident the George Washington's Birthday Massacre, a term that stuck. Interestingly, Udall was one of several dozen congressmen who had written a much-publicized letter to Carter only 5 days earlier, saying, "During your campaign, you stated many times that as president you would halt the construction of unnecessary and environmentally destructive dams. We support your efforts to reform the water resources programs of the Army Corps of Engineers and the Bureau of Reclamation." Reminded of this, Udall was gracious enough to admit that one man's vital water resources project is another man's boondoggle. His colleagues were not so gracious. Words like infamous, dastardly, incredible, incomprehensible, and mind-boggling peppered the pages of the Congressional Record. If Carter was counting on help from anyone, it was the press. After all, newspapers had been criticizing other regions' public works projects since the nation's founding, and the national press was nothing if not cynical about Congress. The press, however, found Carter a better target than the projects themselves. Even Principal David S. Broder wrote in the Washington Post that Carter would let something like the Red River Project put him at odds with the man, Senator Russell Long, whose cooperation is essential for passage of all the vital economic, energy, health, and welfare legislation on the administration's agenda, is so unlikely that some observers conjured up a theory that made the president seem much shrewder. Evidently, Broder couldn't fathom a stand of principle on something as inconsequential as a new $900 million artificial waterway a few jumps away from the Mississippi River. Newsweek and Time made a desultory effort to explain the projects to their readers that implied that people, not surplus crops, as was the case, were using most of Arizona's water. Time unquestionably accepted Morris Udall's prediction that without the cap, Tucson and Phoenix are going to dry up and blow away. There was good coverage in Science, National Journal, and Congressional Quarterly, but those were publications few read. The intensity of the reaction from Congress and the affected regions was so white-hot that Carter had to move much more quickly than he had reckoned toward conciliation. In a letter to Congress, he chastised its members for authorizing projects that made so little sense, but promised regional hearings on every project in question and invited the leadership to the White House for a talk. It was hardly the kind of talk he had in mind. All they did was tell him what an idiot he was for doing this, said Carter's House lobbyist Jim Free. It was like a lynch mob. He was the sheriff throwing calm facts back at them, but they kept yelling at him to release the projects. One congressman kept banging his fist on the table. They compared him to Nixon, the imperial presidency lion. They were rude. They interrupted him. And most of them belonged to his own party. Despite its best efforts, Congress couldn't budge Carter. He may have been naive, but he was adamant. Seeing this, Congress, as the New Republic remarked, began breaking out the high-minded rhetoric that congressmen reserve for their grubbiest and most cynical undertakings. Majority Leader Jim Wright of Texas, for example, wrote a letter to his colleagues urging them to help defend the constitutional prerogative of Congress. The White House, Wright said, in trying to dictate budgetary line items, is reaching for powers never granted any administration by Congress. This was the same Jim Wright who was one of the key backers of the constitutionally dubious Gulf of Tonkin resolution. It was the same Jim Wright who, in defiance of his own constituents, who had decisively rejected a bond issue to help finance the proposed Trinity River project, kept sticking money for it back into the public works appropriations bills. Senator Edmund Muskie of Maine picked up Wright's imperial presidency line in the Senate. The same Edmund Muskie who was pushing the Corps' $800 million Dickey Lincoln Dam on the St. John River, even as it was opposed by both the president and minority leader of the Maine Senate, by Maine's two U.S. representatives, by most of the local newspapers, and according to several opinion polls, by a majority of the people in the state. Senator Robert Byrd of West Virginia said, "A project is not pork barrel to someone who has to shovel black mud or see his home swept away." The most recent flood disaster in Byrd's state, which killed more than 60 people, was caused by the collapse of a dam, and the West Virginians most immediately threatened by flooding were the homeowners who lived in the valley behind Stonewall Jackson Dam. Notwithstanding Congress's threats, Carter continued to move his water reforms along. Simply applying a reasonable discount, or interest, rate of 6.75%, still too low, but reasonable, the hit list easily swelled to 80 projects. Vice President Walter Mondale, who regarded the hit list as a terrible idea from the start, told Carter that a stand against 80 projects would be his last. With reluctance, he and his water policy staff began a deliberate effort to winnow it down. the Tennessee Tom Bigbee Waterway would devour more money for a more illusory purpose than anything on the list, but it had to be left alone. Even the NAACP was for it. The Red River Project was also to survive. Carter had evidently read David Broder's column. Animas La Plata in New Mexico and Colorado offered something to the local Indian population. It would survive. In most cases, Carter was going against his own deeper instincts when he let a project slip by. Once, in the midst of a string of rank political judgments, he called Charlie Warren of the Council on Environmental Quality over to his office. He spent the first half hour telling Charlie about how outrageously wasteful and harmful some of the projects were, says one of Warren's aides. Then, together, he and Warren reduced the final hit list to 18 projects. On April 18th, Carter announced his final, unalterable decision on the projects. It was obvious to anyone that the administration had tried to steer around states from where powerful committee chairmen came. Nonetheless, it couldn't help crashing into some formidable egos and interest groups along the way. There were three projects in Colorado, Dolores, Fruitland Mesa, and Savory Pot Hook, which was home to the second-largest congressional delegation in the West and a Democratic governor, Dick Lamb, who hadn't hesitated to attack Carter before. The Dayton, Plainsville, and Yatesville projects were all in Kentucky, a swing state in an election year. There were Cache Basin in Arkansas, Grove Lake in Kansas, the Harbor Project and the Bayou Buff. Shane and Black Channel were both in Louisiana, Russell Long notwithstanding. There was Dickey Lincoln in Maine, Merrimack Park in Missouri, Lukfada Lake in Oklahoma, peanuts as such projects go, but irresistible because the only real beneficiary of a $39 million investment would be a private catfish farm. And then, to make the whole effort financially worthwhile, there were five immense projects, none of them worth less than $500 million, two of them likely to end up costing six or seven times that much, all conceived by the Bureau of Reclamation. Garrison in North Dakota, Owyhee in South Dakota, Auburn Dam in California, the Central Utah Project, and then, one could almost sense the administration crunching the bullet between its teeth, the most expensive project the West had ever seen, the rival of Tennessee Tom Bigbee itself, the Central Arizona Project. Carter said he wanted all of the projects terminated. Not just unfunded, terminated. As Carter had by then come to expect, the decibel level was highest from within his own party. Republicans, of course, stood up for their own threatened projects, but the minority leader in the House, Congressman Robert Michael of Illinois, said privately, and sometimes not so privately, that he thought the hit list was a pretty good idea. It was the Democratic leadership, their values and spending habits unchanged since the New Deal, that gave Carter fits. In a lectern-thumping floor speech, Jim Wright said that Carter was carrying his environmental ideas so far he threatened to become a laughingstock. Then, to show that he too was an environmentalist, Wright held up a glass of water to extol its goodness. Public Works Commissioner Chairman Ray Roberts said Carter was a captive of environmental extremists and budget hackers. House Speaker Tip O'Neill took the highly unusual, and for Carter embarrassing, step of arranging a meeting with the New York Times to complain that Carter was not listening to Congress. Senators Gary Hart and Floyd Haskell of Colorado began to pepper the administration with Freedom of Information Act requests, ostensibly to learn how their projects were selected. They implied that we were practicing some kind of secret skullduggery. A Carter staff member complained bitterly later on. The skullduggery was when the Bureau justified those dams, not when we re-evaluated them. Even Mondale began undermining Carter's effort, whether he knew it or not, by going around the country privately assuring Democrats that it was all a phase, that Carter meant well, of course, but that he was certainly subject to reason. On June 13th, the House Appropriations Committee, studded with Democrats, reported out its own version of the 1978 Public Works Appropriations Bill. If Carter had hoped it would heed his request and delete the 18 projects, he was mistaken. The committee bill represented not only outright but vindictive defiance of his wishes. Only one of the projects he wanted to abandon, Grove Lake in Kansas, which lacked firm support even in the district where it was to be built, was omitted. Everything else was generously funded, some with minor conditions attached. Auburn Dam wouldn't receive more money until it was a better idea whether or not an earthquake would destroy it. On top of that, money was included for a dozen new projects nowhere to be found in the administration's budget. And on top of that, there was a section of the bill that rejuvenated the Cross Florida Barge Canal, which was anathema to environmentalists and which Richard Nixon himself decided to halt in 1971. Publicly, Carter said nothing. Privately, he was seething. "The only way now is a veto," one of his aides was quoted as saying. "We're in a game of chicken." A quick headcount, however, showed that the Senate could muster the two-thirds majority required to override a veto. If he was serious about vetoing the bill, Carter would have to shore up his support in the House. With moral support from the administration, and perhaps some rewards, to his chagrin, Carter was learning that he might have to resort to the pork barrel to win his fight against the pork barrel, the House was a distinct possibility. It would only take one branch of Congress to win. Carter's lobbyists, Frank Moore and Jim Free, worked the House furiously, joined by the railroads, which were being undercut by competition from federally subsidized barge traffic, lobbyists from the conservation groups, and every dissident farmer, businessman, rancher, and mayor from a project region whom they could get to come to Washington to help them. Vote by vote, the frailest of margins was stitched together. On the straight headcount, Carter would surely lose. The problem was holding Congress's margin below the two-thirds necessary for an override. Many congressmen, especially those whose support would take great political courage, South Carolina's Butler Derrick, for example, who had opposed Richard Russell Dam in his own district, or Philip Barton of California, who leaned heavily on labor support, demanded absolute assurances that Carter would veto the bill. If they voted not to override and he signed in anyway, their embarrassment would be acute. Meanwhile, the administration was fighting insubordination within its own ranks. The Bureau of Reclamation was widely suspected of feeding numbers to Capitol Hill that made the administration's figures appear suspect. The Corps, which had more than once disregarded the wishes of its commander-in-chief, was suspected by Carter's people of doing the same thing. Once, as Jim Free was passing by the Public Works Committee room, he noticed several high-ranking officers of the Corps talking with Ray Roberts. Free stopped and eavesdropped long enough to capture the gist of their conversation. "They were laughing about how they were going to beat us at our own game," he says. By fall, as the showdown approached, the Senate had already passed a close equivalent of the House bill. Moore and Free were finally convinced they had the votes to stop an override in the House. Tip O'Neill, the House Speaker, who wanted to avoid such an outcome at all costs, was apparently sure of it, too. At the last minute, he decided to play his trump card. "Tip called Ham Jordan, the president's top aide," remembers Free, "and made him a bargain. Something would be worked out on Clinch River," the demonstration breeder reactor which Carter wanted to stop even more than the water projects. "A few projects would be deleted, and Tip would help the president get a reform process going." "It was a nice piece of work," Free grudgingly admits. "They went right to Hamilton because he was the closest thing we had to a good old boy. He was also in a little trouble for not returning people's phone calls and things like that. If he worked out a compromise, it would make him look good, and they knew it." O'Neill's offer was actually far less than it seemed. Although he had gotten Tom Bevel to agree to take 9 projects out of the 1978 bill, he had not secured a firm promise that he would not put them back in next year. The same applied to Clinch River. The compromise might slow it down, but there was no commitment to stop it, even for a couple of years. Bevel had also agreed to a 3% across-the-board cut in funding, but that did not affect the ultimate cost of the projects. If anything, it made them more expensive in the long run. No one knew exactly what had been discussed except O'Neill and Jordan and Carter themselves. Had O'Neill promised that the projects were out for good, or had Carter simply accepted that on faith? Did he really believe he had stopped the Clinch River reactor? No one who was intimately familiar with Bevel or with Congress believed they were in a mood to make such an offer. Andrus and Guy Martin were still urging Carter to veto the bill. Now that he had gone this far, they argued, he couldn't abandon the fight unless he got nearly everything he had asked for. There was no indication from the White House that Carter felt otherwise. Up until the last moment, says Free, I was being told and was telling everyone that he was going to veto. Then, with no advance word to anyone, Carter signed the bill. Carter's allies in Congress were thunderstruck. No one had been forewarned. Butler Derrick, according to his staff, was white with anger. Silvio Conti, the one senior Republican member on the House side who vociferously supported the administration, said that he would never trust Carter again on anything. His own lobbyists were furious. Even Andrus, who had opposed the hit lists from the beginning, was mad. Free, a young Tennessean, had made a local boy makes good profile published about him in his hometown newspaper, which happened to be in the district where Columbia Dam was to be built, and his parents had received so much verbal abuse because he was lobbying against the dam that they unlisted their phone number and took their name off their mailbox. It hardly seemed worthwhile after that, Free said dejectedly. Even though Carter protested that the compromise was a good one, it was still unclear exactly what it meant, and would remain so for over a year, one thing was becoming abundantly clear. Carter was already in a mood to retreat. He had underestimated Congress's passion for dams and overestimated his ability to move the rest of his legislative program forward. In January of 1977, Cecil Andrus told the New York Times, "Thank God there'll be no more hit lists." A lot of fence mending was obviously being done. Later that month, Lou Cannon, the Washington Post's correspondent in San Francisco, could write that the West's Democratic governors have been offered unconditional surrender by the Carter administration, which has backed away from nearly every position on water projects. An options paper, drafted shortly thereafter and leaked to Carter's chagrin, to the environmental groups made no mention of several of the main water policy reforms Carter had spoken of earlier. Having reversed himself once, however, Carter was perfectly capable of reversing himself again. In October of 1978, his second big challenge on water projects came around. The fiscal year 1979 Public Works Appropriations Bill that emerged from the House and Senate Conference Committee did exactly what most of Carter's advisors said it would. To begin with, it restored money for every one of the 9 projects deleted the previous year. Carter, in his innocence, evidently believed that the projects had been killed for good, and he was livid. On top of that, the bill contained money for a number of new starts, despite the fact that inflation was well into double digits, interest rates were topping 15%, and a balanced budget was slipping out of Carter's grasp. Once again, Jim Free began making his rounds on Capitol Hill, urging support of a presidential veto when the vote came, even though the administration's allies were still seething over Carter's performance with the previous year's bill. Whatever doubts they had about Carter's courage, however, were soon stilled. A few days later, after making a terse, angry statement denouncing it, Carter vetoed the entire appropriations bill. The timing of the veto, as it happened, coincided neatly with the passage of Proposition 13 in California, a draconian measure which effectively held the annual increase in property taxes to about 1%. Everyone knew the public was fed up with government spending. This was the first sign that it was really fed up. The main sponsor of the measure, a real estate lobbyist named Howard Jarvis, instantly became something of a celebrity. And though the rest of the country felt that California was more than slightly daft, everything that happened there had an odd way of spreading eastward. One of the people who realized this right away was Larry Rockefeller, the nephew of Nelson and son of his older brother Lawrence. Rockefeller, who was then a staff attorney at the Natural Resources Defense Council, was 36, almost neurotically shy, and a strikingly gifted propagandist and politician. Almost single-handedly, he pieced together the Alaska Coalition, the vast umbrella organization that was responsible, 2 years later, for passage of the Alaska Lands Act, which created, in an instant, as much federal parkland as the country had set aside in more than 100 years. The full-page advertisements run by the Alaska Coalition were written and often paid for by Rockefeller, and they were astute. Mostly, they talked about how much resource development and fabulous economic growth the Alaska Lands Act would still allow. The Alaska campaign was based on persuasion. To make Congress sustain Carter's veto of the appropriations bill, however, a campaign would have to be based on fear. There was too little time to try any other tack, and fear seemed to be the one universal motivator on Capitol Hill. At that particular moment, Rockefeller reasoned, Congressmen feared no one more than Howard Jarvis. Getting Jarvis's cooperation was surprisingly easy. Although the value of real estate in his hometown, Los Angeles, depended entirely on aqueducts bringing water from three directions, they were already built. Besides, an opportunity to take on Congress was more than the feisty old man could resist. Rockefeller recalled some of Jarvis's speeches, shut himself in his office, and imagined what sort of advertisement Jarvis might write. When he finished a draft, he read it to him over the phone. Jarvis was stunned. "That's just what I would have said," he answered. On the morning of October 5th, with a vote to override Carter's veto just hours away, 400-odd members of the House opened their copies of the Washington Post and the New York Times and saw the scowling visage of Howard Jarvis staring back at them. "It's an outrage," he croaked. "The Public Works Appropriations Bill is the big tax, big government, big spending, big waste bill of the year." During the debate that day, the spirit of Howard Jarvis was invoked several times. When the vote was taken, the attempt to override Carter's veto had barely failed. As the damned saboteurs in Carter's administration were to discover, however, victories over the congressional pork barrel system tend to be short-lived. They are especially short-lived if they come 13 months before an election year. In July of 1979, a group of California's wealthiest irrigation farmers, many of them from the Westlands Water District, played host to Rosalind Carter at a big Democratic fundraiser in Fresno. Soon thereafter, a number of big growers from the nominally conservative San Joaquin Valley were making hefty campaign contributions to the Carter-Mondale re-election campaign. Their reward was a new water contract obligating them to pay only $9.10 an acre-foot, well below cost, and a subsidy worth $60 million over the term of the contract. Westlands, which the Bureau had illegally expanded back in the 1960s at the behest of the farmers, was the one place where Carter could put one of his most ballyhooed reforms, realistic water pricing, to work, because the illegal expansion had technically voided the original contract. He not only failed to do that, but by caving in on an issue he could easily have won, Westlands had no other source of water except groundwater, which was running out, and therefore had little choice but to accept the administration's terms, he sent a signal to Congress that he was prepared to do business with them. It was just the beginning. Carter had entered office convinced that the 160-acre land limitation in the Reclamation Act was a sound principle. But in Congress, there was talk of removing the acreage limitation altogether and of allowing unlimited leasing, which was, in effect, the same thing as removing the limitation. The more moderate proposals called for a limit of 1,260 acres, an eightfold expansion. Most of Carter's advisers were telling him that he had to hang tough on the acreage issue. If subsidized water suddenly became available to the biggest growers in the West, it would not only be an outrageous subsidy of the wealthy, but it would intensify pressure for even more projects. Assistant Interior Secretary Guy Martin, the administration's canniest strategist on Western water policy, says he recommended a revised acreage limit of perhaps 600 acres, a compromise which, he felt, the administration could sell. By late 1979, however, Martin's boss, Cecil Andrus, was suddenly agreeing with Jerry Brown, another lapsed champion of the 160-acre limit, on a new limit of 1,260